Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, pledging to help end child hunger in the Carolinas through ongoing support of Second Harvest Food Bank of Metrolina. Details about this initiative at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. For working parents, childcare is often a necessity, an expensive one. Some parents pay $10,000 a year per child or more, and that leads to a difficult calculation. At what point does it actually pay to stay home and not work? Since the pandemic disrupted the economy, many parents have done that calculation because childcare is one of the places where serious cracks are showing. About a third of all working mothers have left their jobs or plan to do so. And for those who want to return to the workforce, finding childcare has become more difficult than ever. Waiting lists were always long, but now staffing shortages are plaguing childcare centers nationwide, in part due to pay. In North Carolina, the median wage for childcare workers in 2019 was $10.62 an hour. Many of those workers were living in poverty and have now left those jobs. They, too, have done a calculation and decided they want more money to return. Those costs, of course, will be passed on to parents already struggling to afford care. Potential solutions can be found in President Biden's Build Back Better agenda, but that bill is being chipped away at in Congress, and the provisions for childcare have become an easy target. So this hour, a closer look at the impact of childcare on everything from gender roles to the economy. Kristen Idakavage is director of Kids Are Kids of Charlotte, which operates multiple childcare facilities locally. Good morning. Welcome to you.
Good morning. Happy to be here.
Janet Singerman is president and CEO of Child Care Resources, Inc. That's headquartered in Charlotte and serving Mecklenburg and surrounding counties. Thank you for joining us. Welcome. Unmute yourself. You have to unmute yourself, Janet.
Good morning. Thank you for having me here this morning. I'm happy to be with you again.
You're welcome. And Marcy Whitebook is founding director and director emerita of the Center for the Study of Childcare Employment at the University of California, Berkeley, and she joins us from California. Thank you for getting up so early to be on this program. Welcome.
I'm glad to be here. Thank you for asking.
Janet Singerman, let me begin with you. Finding childcare was difficult before the pandemic. As I said, parents report years-long waiting lists to get their child into daycare. Some parents have to get their kids on their list long before they even think about becoming pregnant. Well, now the problem is worse. You run a nonprofit childcare resource and referral agency that works with families to provide access. It sounds like industry is at an all-time high demand. Why the obvious shortages, though, even before the pandemic?
Well, let's start with where we were before the pandemic and take us a little bit further. Childcare has generally been fairly adequately supplied in Mecklenburg County. Really across the county, infants and toddlers were always in shorter supply. Infant toddler slots are always in shorter supply than 3 to 5 year old slots and school age childcare slots. But the crisis was not then what it is now. And the pandemic has certainly had an impact on the supply of childcare in the Mecklenburg market and beyond the market. And just to put that in context, while we feared that the pandemic would result in the closure of many, many childcare programs across the region. In fact, and I'm going to focus on Mecklenburg right now, we've had a modest impact on the closure and reduction of childcare in the county because of all the supports that North Carolina put into place to help stabilize childcare during the pandemic. So bottom line for that, childcare centers, we lost 12 childcare centers, down 3%. We lost capacity of about 2,300, just over 2,300 slots, down 9%. Enrollment hasn't recovered. So we're down 44% in enrollment in September of this year versus February of 2020. So enrollment, which is the revenue generator for childcare, has not recovered in the way childcare has been stabilized. Family childcare, similar statistics. We're down 12 programs. We're down licensed capacity of only 49 slots, but our enrollment there is down 42%. So overall, we're down 5% in programs, down 9% in slots, and down 44%. We have 10,423 fewer children enrolled. And so that squeezes the budgets of childcare programs. which has an impact on whether or not they can afford to hire staff if staff are out there to be hired. So we have a supply side issue, but now we have really a staffing crisis, and Child Care Resources and Child Care Services Association and Southwestern Child Development Commission are coming out with a statewide staffing study later this week that really documents that we are losing staff. And even though we have programs open, we don't have enough staff to staff the classrooms in those programs. That's why the waiting lists are longer than they were pre-pandemic.
So what we have here is what's going on in many other industries. The whole thing is just out of whack because of the layoffs that happened during the pandemic and the closures, the temporary or otherwise, that happened during the closures. Kristen, CNBC reports that parents are spending nationally $42 billion on early child care. That's more than federal and state spending combined. And as I mentioned, parents are paying sometimes in excess of $10,000 a year per child for child care. And if you have multiple children in need of that child care, that's college tuition right there. The calculation has to be made by parents whether it's worth it going to work. What costs, and we're going to talk about pay scales of the workers in these child care centers in a second, but what are the costs that keep what goes into making the cost so high? That's the question.
Yeah, I agree with that. And I think that estimate of $10,000 a year is probably on the very low end of what that average is, not just in Charlotte, but probably across the country as well. I know that's a good ways off. It does cost a lot to provide quality experiences for young children. We need to make sure that they're safe and healthy first. Pre-pandemic costs were a lot different than they are now. We've seen a huge increase in just the cost of our day-to-day operations in terms of latex gloves, plates, cups, food service items, all of those things, and those costs have grown exponentially over the past 18 months. We'll have spent probably close to just $20,000 in 1 year on latex gloves alone. Mm. We're talking, an increase of $40 a case to $170 a case right now. And so those costs have risen. And again, labor is your biggest cost. And that median wage of $10.62, I'm happy to report that while our teachers make more than that, thankfully, labor remains our biggest cost of care right now.
Well, Marcy, let's talk about that. Marcy Whitebook is with us. She's the founding director and director emerita for the Center for the Study of Child Care Employment at the University of California at Berkeley. And for years, you have worked to gain raises and respect for people in the industry, for workers, frontline workers in the early childhood workforce. Your studies show that of all educators, childhood workers are the most undervalued in terms of pay, which puts them at the bottom of the heap of most all workers. You say that those who teach and care for young children are among the lowest paid workers in every state. And the Washington Post reports one child care worker has called the pay absolute crap. That is a quote. Why are they unvalued, and why are they certainly underpaid?
Well, I think why they're undervalued has a long history in our country and really around the world, around work done by women generally seen as unskilled. And so it's always lower paid. I think in addition to that, the way our system evolved as a private system from the beginning was predicated on the idea that you don't really have to pay the people who do the work very much because they're doing it because it's a service, or they're doing it out of the goodness of their hearts. And although people who are working in childcare will say we love working with children, people are doing it because they have to make a living. And so we've never really challenged that. And and it also has a lot to do with race, that in our country, Black women in particular, but also immigrant women, the people who are doing the work, are generally considered it's okay for them to have low paid jobs or lower paid jobs. So we've got a lot of cultural things mixing in there. But I think but really what our problem is that we are one of the few industrialized countries that has such limited investment from the government for it. We basically really, I mean, I think Kristen was laying out that what it costs to run a program and how much is not the basis on which we actually have money coming in. It's based on what parents can afford to pay. And then once that happens, you then are left with whatever you have to pay the workers. And so I think if you look at, you know, element public schools, we would have the same problem in public schools if we expected parents to pay for all of schooling. I mean, the whole community shares it through our taxes. And so that isn't the case in the US. And basically, for most families, what the child care you get for your children is based on what you can afford to pay. So it's a very inequitable system in that regard. But basically, we don't have enough money in the system.
I want to come back to something you said at the very beginning when you said a lot of people view these workers, these child care employees, as unskilled. It doesn't take a lot of skill to do these jobs. They're just taking care of kids and changing diapers for the younger ones. You say, however, that people have a hard time seeing that this is actually complex, specialized work. And at the better child care facilities, they are educators. They are not just babysitters. Would that be accurate?
Yes. I mean, I think through the people doing the work, and it depends on your state regulations, but most people have some college courses. So a lot of people have AA degrees and bachelor's degrees. It's very complex work to do it well. And I think that, you know, in the last 30, 40 years, we've had tons of information about how important the work is. And the National Academy of Sciences said that everybody doing this work needs foundational knowledge and, you know, more advanced knowledge if they're going to be leading a classroom or leading a home. But I think it's one of those things where we haven't aligned what we've come to learn about the way children develop and the importance of the early years with the system that we have. And so I think many people still think of it as, oh, it's babysitting, as something, you know, anybody can do. And it is true, all parents take care of their children, but it's a really different experience to be in a group of children and really thinking about how you create an environment for them for many hours a day that addresses each child's individual needs and all of the group needs that's appropriate for where they are developmentally. So it's very complex work. I was an infant toddler teacher in my early years, and that's sort of how I got into this, because I was like, wow, this is the hardest thing I've ever done in my life. And even reflecting back, I would still say it was the hardest job I've ever had, because it required so much of me physically, mentally, being on every minute that you're with the children, and then also having to figure out what each child needed. And I think that it's disheartening to me that after all these years, we still really haven't, change the way we think about the work of caring for young children enough to say, well, let's do something about it. And although many, many people in the country, both sides of the aisle, say, yes, we should be putting more into early childhood because this is one of the problems, along with having enough services for families that we need to address, it's kind of the thing that always can be put on the back burner. You know, we've had a bad system for so many years. We've learned to tolerate it.
Let me stop you there. I know, Janet, you want to chime in on this, and I'll let you do that after we come back from the break at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to Mazda's focus to ensure every element of a car is designed around the driver. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about childcare, how expensive it is, how difficult it is to get in, and how low-paid the jobs of the people actually providing the care turn out to be. Kristen Idakavage is director of Kids Are Kids. Marcy Whitebook is founding director of the Center for the Study of Childcare Employment at UC Berkeley. And Janet Singerman is president and CEO of Childcare Resources, Inc. And I know, Janet, you wanted to jump in here and talk about what Marcy was addressing a moment ago.
Sure. Thanks very much. I really just wanted to put into context some of the sort of dilemma or trilemma that we're talking about. The cost of care in Mecklenburg County for the first 5 years of childcare is just under $65,000 a year. $65,000 a year, that's average cost of childcare, so it can be higher than that. 4 years college tuition and fees at UNCC are $27,620, and at Chapel Hill, just about $32,000. So compare the cost of childcare when parents are in their early earning years, the cost of college when parents have gained in earnings, presumably, and you see how disproportionate the expense is at the early years of a child's life. And so the challenge is parents can't afford to pay more. Childcare program operators like Kristen can't charge more because parents can't afford to pay it. And childcare staff can't afford to earn less. That's where we are in this crisis. So we do need third-party investment from federal and state government, private sector, to make the economics of childcare work for families and for employers. I was really struck by the New York Times article on October 10th. There was a Greensboro early educator who was quoted in that article. Her name is Rachel Myers. She has an associate's degree in early childhood education, and she has a 60-hour work week, which she splits between a childcare center, Greensboro's Friendly Avenues Childcare Center, and Starbucks. And her quote was this: "I make $10 an hour to shape the future of children and make $15 an hour to hand someone a cup of coffee. That doesn't make sense." This is what we're talking about.
And Starbucks has benefits.
And most childcare programs are unable to offer their staff health benefits.
Well, Kristen, let's talk about that for just a couple of seconds, because Janet just outlined the difference in cost between college and daycare, and it almost sounds ridiculous to make that comparison when you consider how we allegedly value a college education. But we should be valuing what's going on in early childhood education, which is what childcare does for young people. It's not, as I said, just a babysitting service. You teach cognitive skills at your locations. You teach language skills, motor skills, social interaction. We know a lot about the impact of doing all those things for children before they get to school and what that does for their success in those early grades of school. Why don't we put our money where our ideas or our realization of the importance of that is as a country?
Yeah, right. I do think it goes back to what Marcy was talking about, just valuing the people that are doing this work. You know, I tell my teachers all the time that they're brain builders, quite literally. At the rate of development that a child goes through in the first 3 to 5 years of their life. So I'm not sure why that funding isn't there. I think it's an easy place to cut when you look at budgets and money coming in. But the work is so important that we can't accept that as an answer any longer, I think. And North Carolina has made strides over the years, and especially during the pandemic, at helping to stabilize this industry. But again, when you look at that, staffing shortages everywhere, we are not immune to that. We've been in a staffing crisis for years in this industry. It's just been quite silent, I think, until recently. And so it's definitely a complex question that has many complex answers.
It's a double-edged sword, it seems to me, Marcy Whitebook. As child care becomes more difficult to obtain, as teachers walk away, as this disruption from the pandemic rears its ugly head, there have to be implications for the economy, because if parents can't find child care, they can't go to work. Also, there's the problem with needing to raise the wages of these employees. At the same time, where childcare has become almost unaffordable for a lot of people, there are impacts all over the economy. Talk about that.
Right. Well, the system is basically broken. That it just doesn't work for almost anybody, right? Parents are paying too much, and for the people doing the work, they basically can't afford to live on their salaries for the most part. Many childcare workers worry about food, housing, transportation, and then for children, it means that they're in either places where there's a lot of turnover, they have stress, you know, caregivers. I mean, we know that when you have a more stable staff, you have better quality of care for children as well. So I think the question is, you know, what does it take? And it seems like it's very clear that we have to move towards financing this differently. And we need a third party payer, as I think Janet was referring to, but well, both Kristen right. too. We need some help. And so I think this kind of goes to your question around Build Back Better, which is, I think that it has some help is promised in that would go a long way towards helping to put more funds in to stabilize the workforce, which is in part with what some of the relief dollars that states got during the pandemic. In North Carolina, it's been one of the best states in really making sure that went to addressing the question of wages. But it really, you can't fix the problem if you don't have more resources. And I just want to say that it's really important to recognize that this problem goes way back. And you can go back to World War I, the day nurseries, and they were going crazy because they couldn't find staff because there were better paying jobs in war industries. Same thing in World War II. We saw it here in California around the dot-com boom, that whenever there's a demand for workers, you have a really much harder time staffing childcare programs. But even when there's not an enormous demand, it's always hard because the work is hard, it's undervalued, and it's low paid. And people might do it for a while, but many people just have to at some point go, just like, I can't make this work for myself and my families. Right. And it's really excruciating to see people make that decision because many of them really wanted to make a life career out of working with young children.
I know, Kristen, you said that you pay more than the $10.62 an hour that the average person around the country who are in the childcare industry makes. I don't want to ask you how much you pay, but is there a break-even point? Is there a breaking point where the price you need to pay and should be paying to these workers simply makes it unaffordable on the other end for parents to take their kids to daycare? Where's that breaking point?
Yeah, I definitely do think that there is a breaking point when it comes to that. We've seen it sometimes too with more senior or more highly educated staff that we've had as well, just in terms of that longevity that we'd like for them to have here. That salary scale just can't go quite as far as we need it to for them. We've watched, unfortunately, over the past 18 months, we've had several staff who have had to leave the program and have had more turnover than we had previously. We found kind of with that middle group. So maybe not with the more highly educated or highly experienced ones that have been with us for a long time, and not with those newer employees who are just kind of getting their foot in the door and starting out, but those ones that kind of fall right in the middle, maybe still working on education, still building experience, where for them that breaking point, they reached it a little bit sooner than they would have liked to, or we would have liked to, because again, as Marcy has mentioned, as Janet has mentioned, the work is not easy. And to be honest, I could pay someone $50 an hour, but if they didn't care about the work they were doing, it would never be enough every other Friday because of how demanding this work is. And rightfully so, it's important work.
Janet, you referred to a New York Times article about all of this. There have been several, and I'm going to quote from one right now. This may be the same article. I don't know. This was called "Moms Are Back to Work, But Childcare Resources Are Laughable." One mother interviewed for that story had to cut back on work to care for her daughter, and of course was paid less at her job as a result of staying home. But her husband is an architect and kept his job, so they're still bringing in money, but they're also both paying back student loans, which means that money is tight. But she says, I am a white, middle-class, super average person. If I struggle this much, I can't even imagine what it's like when it comes to others who don't have it, like me. What is it like?
It forces impossible choices for families, really. Just forces impossible choices between, are we paying rent? Are we paying for food? Are we paying for transportation? Are we paying for childcare? These are the difficult choices that lower income families face when they are searching for childcare. And access to childcare subsidy. You know, Childcare Resources is the childcare subsidy administrator for Mecklenburg County. The good news that I have right now is for those who meet eligibility requirements, we have no waiting lists for children ages birth to 5. So childcare subsidy is available if you're a family that is working in school up to 30 hours per week, and are, in the case of a birth to 5-year-old child, earning up to 200% of poverty. So childcare subsidy is available in Mecklenburg County. It isn't available statewide. Mecklenburg County has increased the availability of childcare subsidy by investing $20 million in our local childcare subsidy program for children birth to 5. So there's one answer, access to childcare subsidy, but there are waiting lists across North Carolina and there are waiting lists across the nation for childcare subsidy. Subsidy is part of an answer. I will tell you, there was a Census Pulse survey done in mid-September that showed in North Carolina alone, 120,850 parents are not working because they're caring for children not in childcare or in school. So this, to your point, has a critical economic impact on economic recovery. But really, the lack of investment in quality, affordable childcare nationwide forces parents into really difficult choices about the safety, well-being, and development of their children during the day, work, and the balancing the other factors, rent, mortgage, transportation, food, et cetera. This is an untenable place for families.
Well, if you've got two kids in daycare, childcare, while you go to work, you're paying a mortgage payment for that care, essentially, which makes it very unaffordable. Janet, you mentioned that Mecklenburg County has subsidies for lower income people, and you administer those subsidies through your organization, Child Care Resources, but you also deal with other surrounding counties. Is there anything similar in those surrounding, what are those counties, and is there anything similar in those counties?
So most child care subsidy is paid for at the federal level, that passes to the state, that passes to the county through the Child Care Development Fund, Child Care Development Block Grant. We serve Mecklenburg, Union, Cabarrus, Rowan, and Stanley counties. And in those counties, child care subsidy is administered through the Department of Social Services. In Mecklenburg County, the Department of Social Services has contracted with us since 1982 to manage the child care subsidy program. And many of those counties may have waiting lists for child care subsidy and may not. The decline of our statewide waiting list right now, which is typically much higher, is related to COVID. It's related to public health concerns and is related to employment trends. So yes, there is the primary source of child care financial aid in the United States is federal, passed to the state, passed to the county, and the rate of consumption is dependent both on childcare supply, employment trends in those communities, and cost of living in those communities, essentially. So everyone can turn to their local Department of Social Services in the other counties to access childcare subsidy, and in Mecklenburg County, turn to Childcare Resources by calling 704-348-2181.
Marcy, you've talked about how child care workers are undervalued and that they are not seen as highly specialized workers, which they are, doing complex specialized work. What would change if we did see them in that light?
Well, I think what would help, actually, is if we were paying people more. Because I think people associate value in part with how much people earn. So people think, oh, this is a low paid job, you know, anyone can do it, and those things just kind of feed on each other. I think one thing I just want to add to the subsidy situation, I mean, really Mecklenburg County is unique in this, although I think in around the country, people's use of subsidy has been reduced because fewer parents are using the system. But before COVID, with the federal block grant, only 15% of the children that were eligible for it were receiving subsidy nationwide. You know, it varied in certain states depending on policies. So what that does is, even when you have subsidy, there's a lot of pressure on states to keep the subsidy rates very low because they want to serve as many kids as they can. And so, like in our state, in the subsidized programs, those can still be low paid. It's better than if there's no subsidy. And the other thing I just want to say to just think about, remember, is that a lot of childcare workers have children of their own. So they have to make that same determination about work. And for childcare workers, the cost of childcare can be a quarter to a third or even more of their income. For people earning minimum wage, it's close to half their income every month. So you've got just this constellation of things kind of feeding on each other. But I think what has to change would be both the wages and making sure that people have benefits like health benefits, paid sick leave, and working conditions that really support their well-being. Right now, we've done studies in many different states. Many workers say that programs are so understaffed that they can't even take their breaks. They're legal, you know, federally required breaks. So I think what would have to happen is we have to rethink of those jobs. And I think I think that's part of what really we just have to make the jobs better. And just to remember, the competition now is Starbucks, Target, you know, other places that, because the way those industries are structured, they can raise the wages, they can add benefits, which many of them are doing right now. So you have the situation where childcare as an industry doesn't have any wiggle room, really, or much wiggle room to raise the wages. And there's a lot of industries that are, and that makes it even harder to keep people.
So you have this double whammy. You had low wages, Kristen, prior to the pandemic, and then the pandemic comes in and upsets all the apple carts in the world at the same time. And you have people reevaluating what they want to do for a living and whether they want to work as hard as they've been working for the money that they've been paid. And that's happening in all industries. So compare the difference between the difficulties you faced in finding qualified people willing to participate in childcare before the pandemic and now.
I think the difference, I mean, I can see it when I post, for an open position on Indeed, where I would get many, many applicants before, qualified applicants prior to the pandemic. And now when I post something and I'm reviewing resumes, I see very few people applying for the positions that are actually qualified to do so. Wow. And so many people looking for a change in position that are applying to work in a childcare setting.
When we come back, maybe some solutions, maybe could be found in the Build Back Better plan, maybe. We'll talk about that in a moment. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, dedicated to those who believe a car should stir one's emotions and deliver a heightened state of driving. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about all of the ramifications of childcare, the costs of parents paying for it, the low pay, and the difficulty in finding workers to engage in that occupation. Janet Singerman is president and CEO of Child Care Resources, Inc. Kristen Ida-Cavage is director of Kids Are Kids, and Marcy Whitebook is the founding director of the Center for the Study of Child Care Employment at the University of California at Berkeley. And Janet, I know that we were just talking about the disruptions of all these different industries because of the pandemic, but North Carolina does have stabilization grants available to child care centers. What about those grants?
Yes, really important to mention that the American Rescue Plan has brought $1.3 billion into North Carolina to help stabilize and advance child care. And just last week, the North Carolina Division of Child Development and Early Education released the applications for stabilization grants. That's $806 million of federal funds that are going into stabilizing child care. Programs can apply for a base level of support to essentially try and make them more whole. They can apply losses incurred since January of 2020 because of the pandemic, and also can and child care programs will receive funds based on average costs of care nationally that the National Association for the Education of Young Children has documented. And then as a second level support, childcare program operators can apply for compensation related supports. So they can apply for resources to increase wages, to access and make available benefits, to implement bonuses for childcare, because we are, as many other states are, having a childcare staffing crisis and compensation has never been adequate. And so with $803 million of American Rescue Plan monies, and this is before we start talking about the Build Back Better Act, we can begin to do something with these dollars that have to be obligated and liquidated by 2024.
But those dollars are temporary. What happens when that money runs out?
They are temporary, and then we're hoping for Build Back Better legislation at the federal level that will begin to better address on a more stable basis both the childcare compensation, childcare quality, and childcare affordability.
So let's talk about that. President Biden's Build Back Better plan is one of the two big bills that are tied up in Congress right now. One is the infrastructure plan that's already passed the Senate, and it's being held up in the House by progressive Democrats who want the Build Back Better portion of the plan to be passed by both houses before they say yes to the infrastructure plan. And the Build Back Better plan was, it started out as $3.5 trillion. Now it's questionable about how much money they will get for that, but it includes lowering child care costs, providing universal preschool, cutting taxes for families with children. When you ask individual people about this out there in the world, they say, yeah, I want all those things. But it's difficult to get them through this package because we're fighting over the big number. This proposal has been called the biggest investment in the history of child care. From what you know of the provisions in the bill, Janet, would that be accurate?
Absolutely accurate. 100% accurate. A historic opportunity, a historic need that has been unmet for the history of childcare.
And what would that mean? What would the passage of this, as you know it, if it were to go through exactly the way it's written, if you know, what would that mean to the average parent who needs childcare?
Well, costs would be capped. We can all contribute to this answer, but costs would be capped at 7% of income. There's a sliding fee scale, so there would be no co-payment for families at incomes of less than 75% of state median income. Right now, childcare subsidy is accessible based on federal poverty level. This would shift the measure of income eligibility to state median income, which is a much higher income. In North Carolina, the state median income is $54,602. That's a higher income threshold than much of income eligibility limits are for child care subsidy. So it enlarges the pool of families that would be accessed for child care, would be able to access child care financial aid. It caps their spending at 7% of income, and that's just on the child care affordability side. We can move to the child care compensation side because there are also provisions for increased compensation for child care staff with a minimum construct of about a $15 per hour construct to build beyond that. And it also establishes, as you said, both supports for quality childcare, which is programming, which may be infrastructure, which are, of course, compensation. And it establishes universal pre-K for 3 to 5 year olds. And this construct of the bill is two parts. One is this universal pre-K construct, and the other is childcare. And states can elect one or both parts. And so the impact of the entire legislation is also going to be dependent on do states elect one part or the other part? And there are some concerns about that, because if you impact, for example, if a state selects a universal pre-K and doesn't select childcare, there could be unintended consequences on the other side of the equation. So as a whole, it's a historic lift for our childcare system and our public pre-K system. For families, for staff, and for our communities in terms of economics.
So, Marcy, there are other aspects to this bill, not just child care, that Senator Joe Manchin from West Virginia is against. He has mentioned that he is worried about turning the United States into an entitlement society. And I don't know whether he's talking about this aspect of the bill being an entitlement. But if working parents can't work, if they don't have access to childcare, wouldn't provisions in this bill be a boon to families and to the economy and therefore not an entitlement? It would pay for itself, would it not?
Yes. I mean, I think that this idea that we're giving something to families that is somehow undermining, you know, their initiative and working on their own to take care of these things is really just an old idea. And basically, this is part of the infrastructure of our country. We have most families have two working parents. You know, people would like to be able to stay home. Some people can, this doesn't have any impact on that. If they leave the child credit in, then that would help families who are not, where both parents aren't in the workforce or a single mother is in the workforce. But basically, it would go a long way towards addressing the child care problem, because it would, all the states would child money, and then with the pre-K money, states will get it if they choose to. There will be some kind of state match and that will go down over time, but it will help states build out their pre-K systems. And that would make an enormous difference. I think one of the things I hear is that people are saying, well, let's choose pre-K over childcare or childcare over pre-K. And in fact, given the reality of parents' lives, people need both childcare and pre-K. We need it all. And so, but it would make a big difference. It would help to stabilize the workforce. As Janet said, there's a provision to set a floor of a living wage to be determined in states and for child subsidy. And there is on the pre-K side also, and somewhat a little unclear on the childcare side, the goal of making sure that people who are teaching who have equivalent credentials to elementary school teachers are paid in the same way. So it would solve a lot. And I think that using the word entitlement, I mean, Social Security is an entitlement. There are different things that we have that benefit everybody. And this is something that there's a strong argument to be made across the board that everybody needs some help around this.
You say that we should assess any child care related policy proposals on if they allow all parents the option to stay home with infants, newly adopted or new foster children, relieve the cost burden of early child care and education for low and middle income families, and improve the quality by investing in the early child care and education workforce. Does this Build Back Better policy proposal, this bill in Congress, does it do any or all of those things?
I think it does all of those things. I think the issue is going to be what's the level of funding. Right. So at the current, it won't take care of all of the problems, but it would go a long, long way to addressing it. There's a paid family leave provision. There's the child credit. There's the early childhood, the structure of the early childhood to relieve costs for parents, expand subsidy. And then there's the pre-K. And also, so yes, I think the question is what's going to look like when it comes out, you know, what, assuming this gets passed, which we does, or I hope it does, then what's the level of funding going to be? In 1971, I guess, Janet, you probably, maybe Kristen, you might know this too, that there...
We just lost you, Marcy. Go back a little bit. Go back about a sentence or two.
Yeah, in 1970.
Yeah, we're losing your audio, Marcy. We're losing your audio. Turn off your video for a second. There we go. Now try it now.
Is that better?
Let's hear you talk.
Okay, in 1971, a bipartisan bill passed Congress for a massive child care plan, and it was about half of the level of the in today's dollars of the current Build Back Better plan. And originally it was cut, by the time it got through Congress and got to the president's desk, which he vetoed, so that's another story, it had been reduced to a sixth of its original proposed cost. So I think the issue will be something is better than nothing for sure, but to really carry out or make real all the provisions of the current early childhood, the child care and the pre-K side of the bill.
Well, we're doing it again. We're losing you again. So, Janet, let me have you jump in here for a second, because Marcy has said that North Carolina is a leader in actually helping this situation be better than it is in other states. True?
Absolutely. North Carolina has long been the leader in early care and education, going way back to we were one of the first two states with a quality rating improvement system. We're a state that has invested in birth to five through Smart Start since before 2000. We have been a leader in really trying to address wage supplements. Child Care Services Association piloted and has expanded the Child Care Teach Scholarship Program and a wage supplement program for many decades now. So we have led in advancing and incenting and aligning strategies to lift child care to higher quality than many other states across the country. And we've been an innovator in that regard. I would just want to add to what Marcy was saying that while we are debating the cost of the Build Back Better Act, and it's clear that there is not yet agreement on the overall cost, there are key components that we believe everyone, I guess all of the advocates on this show believe, really have to be maintained. And that is the childcare component and the preschool component, because both help families in different ways. Both are critically important to be included in any final bill approved by Congress. And, you know, childcare is a support for families, but childcare is a support for employers and support for our economy. We really have to think about this in terms of how the ripple effect of childcare on families, on employment, on our economy as a whole, and on the future generations of the adults that these children will become. All the brain science tells us this. This is the time for us to get this right at the federal level. And so as advocates, we are trying to advance and increase awareness about what is at stake and preserve the historic investment that is both in childcare, but there's paid family leave in this bill too. So there are a variety of supports. There is free community college in the bill too. So that will help our workforce, really the return on investment in becoming a child care worker, since wages are so low right now, is limited. This bill addresses so many of the needs of our industry that have plagued our industry for its history.
Kristen, you wrote an op-ed in the South Charlotte Weekly recently in which you say the system in place here is simply not enough when we are struggling to attract and retain qualified educators, to keep childcare businesses open in the face of added health and safety costs, and to find enough spaces for children so their parents can work. Your impressions of the Build Back Better bill, will that help? And if that doesn't pass, or it passes at an amount that's not sufficient, what would help? What is needed?
Yeah, I do think that the Build Back Better bill answers a lot of those questions and concerns that we've had. And for me, it's kind of simple that, and Janet mentioned it just a second ago, is that if the end result that we're looking for is a healthy economy, we need to not only support the workforce that supports the workforce, but we have to fund it adequately. We've taken whatever change has been jingled in a pocket and tossed at us for many, many years. And now is the time for people to really step up and put that money behind it and fund it. And that the bill answers most of those questions.
Americans tend to think short term when other countries think long term. And if you take a long term view of this, although some people see this as a problem only for people with children, it's actually a problem for everybody in the economy, because children are a boost to the economy today, because parents have to buy and spend on those children, which increases the economy. They're a must for tomorrow's workforce. Without kids, there'd be nobody taking care of older people and nobody earning any money as the older workers age out. This is a boost to capitalism, is it not? Very quickly. Kristen.
Yes. 100%.
Okay. I'll have to leave it at that because we are completely out of time. Kristen Ida-Cavage is director of Kids Are Kids. Janet Singerman is president and CEO of Child Care Resources, Inc. And Marcy Whitebook joined us from California, where she is the founding director of the Center for the Study for Childhood Employment at the University of California at Berkeley. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, pledging to help end child hunger in the Carolinas through ongoing support of Second Harvest Food Bank of Metrolina. Details about this initiative at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.